Toli, Ballet Flamenco Jose Porcel, and family entertainers Dan Zanes and Michael Cooper during the 2005-2006 season. Watch for your Krannert Center season brochure the first week of May or visit KrannertCenter.com. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about, looking at, examining, thinking about the images that Westerners have long had about East Asia. And it is true, for a long time, that the West has viewed Asia as exotic, as erotic to the point of decadence, with an undercurrent of danger running through it. And you can see it in the writings of Westerners about Asia going all the way back to Marco Polo running all the way through the popular culture of today, movies and television. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Sheridan Prosso. She's a journalist, and she's been writing about Asia for quite a while now, more than 15 years. And she's authored a book that explores these images, what they are, where they come from, how they fail to square with reality, and what that means for the relationship between the East and the West. The book is titled The Asian Mystique, and it is out now just recently, published by Public Affairs. The subtitle of the book is Dragon Ladies, Geisha Girls, and Our Fantasies of the Exotic Orient, and should be available now if you'd like to head out to the bookstore and take a look at the book. Let me tell you just a little bit more about Sheridan Prosso. She has been Asia editor and senior news editor for Business Week magazine. Also, her articles have appeared in Time, The New Yorker, The New Republic, The New York Times, The LA Times, and other publications. She is an advisor to the Asia Society's Social Issues Programs and also member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the National Committee on the U.S.-China Relations. She makes her home in New York City. She's talking with us by telephone this morning. And as we talk, questions, as always, are welcome. 333-9455 is the number for people here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line if it's a long-distance call for you. You're listening around Illinois and Indiana. Could even be listening on the Internet. As long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Prosso, hello.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly do appreciate it. I think in the book you talk about having gone to Asia as a journalist for the first time and admit that, like many other Westerners, many, that you came to Asia with a set of preconceptions that you fairly quickly discovered did not square with reality.
That's right. I think, you know, when we read travel writing about Asia or sort of some of the novels that were set over the past century, you know, we get this idea of Asia being sort of an exotic, incense-shrouded place of silks and decadence and sexuality. And in reality, you know, most Asian cities are, in fact, a lot like American cities when you actually go and spend time in places like Hong Kong and Singapore and Shanghai and Tokyo. The sort of mystical Orient is really more or less a figment of Western fantasy and imagination.
Mm-hmm. I think you also make the point, it's well taken point, that in as much as we have tried, we have certainly made an effort here in the United States and I'm sure in Europe to be sensitive to racial stereotypes. It also seems that we have a very difficult time letting go of those, and you've mentioned them, those applying to Asians, especially to Asian women.
Yeah. In part, it's because our stereotypes are, in our view, tend to be positive ones, at least concerning Asian women anyway. With Asian males, it's quite different. But with Asian women, you know, we grew up watching shows like The Courtship of Eddie's Father with, you know, Mrs. Livingston saying, "Yes, Mr. Eddie's father," you know. And all of the images that we have in the West are kind of lovely and beautiful and often sort of cast Asians in a more submissive role, which, you know, is a very comfortable one for Westerners to be in. when dealing with the region. And as I talk about in the book, that has a real impact on not only Asian Americans, but Asians in terms of dealing with East-West relations and business relationships, and even affects our foreign policy, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned, and as you've touched on, for a long, long time, the West has viewed Asia through this lens, the exotic, the erotic, the dangerous, a very feminized view of Asian culture. And as I said, you see it as far back as the first travel writings about Asia we have, all the way back to Marco Polo, and you can see that, and it runs all the way through popular culture today. Even today's Asian action heroines still embody those classic sort of characteristics. I mean, maybe Lucy Liu is a step forward from Anna Mae Wong, but, you know, in a lot of ways, not much. So it's the big question that you devote this large section of the book to, when you're citing examples of this, seems to be why is it that in the Western image of East Asia, sex is so prominent a feature? Why is it so much about sex?
It's quite interesting how historically that has been a focus of our interaction with Asia. In part, it has to do because the first travelers to Asia, of course, were men who had been on boats for a very long time, and a lot of their first interaction with Asia had to do with sex. And that's what happens with explorers and, you know, traders and in exotic ports. And so this very much became characteristic of the West's first contact with Asia, and also how our relations proceeded from there. When you had, you know, men going and living in trading ports in Asia, living there for a very long time, there was a phenomenon of, for example, in Japan, in Nagasaki, of traders taking temporary wives. And one of these temporary wives actually has become our story of Madame Butterfly, which actually it's quite interesting to note the transmutation of this story over the years. In fact, it started out as a story where this was a woman who was quite calculating, and you know, when her man returned to her to find to say goodbye or something he had forgotten in the original story, the woman was found counting her change and waiting for her next quote-unquote husband. But by the time we ended up with an opera out of it, the way Puccini wrote it was, even Puccini's version of it has gone through a couple incarnations. The first time, the woman was viewed as too calculating and not adoring enough of her man. But by the time we got to the version that we know today, we have a woman who is completely adoring and willing to die for this man that she loves. And this has yet become, you know, something that has formed and shaped, you know, our Western images of Asia and continues to this day.
Mm. One of the things that I guess occurred to me, and as you talked about what happened when Westerners, Europeans, I guess primarily, but also Americans, were trying to get to know the culture of the East, that and perhaps finding it difficult, and understandably maybe finding it difficult, that it occurred to me that in some ways perhaps sexual intercourse is easier, is less problematic than social intercourse. And so maybe it's not surprising that that is the thing that is the easiest to do.
Well, certainly that was the case in Shanghai in the early part of the last century. And in fact, what was the case in that time, there were all these British traders setting up in the port of Shanghai, and it was forbidden for any of these, it was forbidden in British culture to actually marry a local woman. But in fact, what really happened was there was quite a bit of not social in an open sense, but a lot of interaction between Asian women or Chinese women and the British men. But it kind of got, because it wasn't allowed in the social scenes in British culture nor in Chinese culture, it kind of became, you know, clandestine, and that sort of added a certain mystique and a certain aura to it. And in fact, because it was also, those mores were a product of the Victorian era in Britain, Victorian era women, English women, had certain restrictions on whether they could enjoy sex, for example, whether that was permitted. You know, there's a line from an old book that I read that, you know, said, you know, proper Victorian women never move. And, you know, the idea is that sex is sort of functional rather than something to be enjoyed. And that sort of Victorian sexual mores sort of opened up an entire sort of, is indeed a founding part of the mystique of sexuality of Asian women, because in fact, when these English men encountered Asian women, they were encountering them in terms that you would encounter sexuality today without those Victorian restrictions.
Mm-hmm. So it seems that kind of Victorian sensibility and a way of thinking about sex is important, although, as we've said, the kinds of images that we have on Asia, they go back further than that. They're rooted back further, and that kind of attitude about sex just strengthened images that already existed.
Certainly, and there's also a root in this that I haven't mentioned yet, which is the missionaries who went to Asia from Europe, and those were that contact was happening very early on, the Portuguese and the Spanish. Even before the British got to East Asia, there was an aspect of missionaries going in to sort of tame the savages, and the idea in that sense that, you know, sexuality was something to be tamed, that Europeans had to kind of impose their sexual mores on Asians who actually at that time had quite different ones from the Europeans, and so the idea that these Asians were sort of, you know, not exactly free love oriented, but had looser kind of social mores involving sexuality was certainly a factor in how they were perceived back home when the missionaries brought back their reports.
Hmm. How is it that, why is it that we think of Asian culture in a general sort of way as feminine?
It in part has to do with the idea of Western dominance of the world. And for a long time, you know, first it was the Spanish and Portuguese who dominated the world in terms of trade. And then later we had, of course, the British and the British Empire. And the Americans are certainly inheritors of that tradition of then extending American dominance into the Pacific and sort of taking over where the British left off at the end of the British Empire. And so in that sense, when you are viewing regions of the world as being sort of under the tutelage of Western power, there's kind of a dominant and then submissive role that comes into that, which very much plays into a lot of the sort of feminine, exotic, silk images of Asia. But apart from that, also the experiences that Westerners encountered with Asian men in part played a large role in that too, because in fact in Shanghai in the period that I was talking about with the British, they encountered Asian men who were their compradors, their go-betweens for trade, and those compradors were dressed in ways that to the British looked very feminine. In styles in those days in China, men wore long silk bannerman's gowns, and they grew their fingernails long, and they wore their hair long in braided queues, and they looked quite feminine. These are styles that now we look at as being feminine ones. When those Chinese first came to the United States, they came during that period, and the first Chinese immigrants to the U.S., males, had long hair, wore silk gowns, and grew their fingernails long. And so these men, of course, came for the gold rush, stayed in San Francisco, and took up what was regarded as women's work after the end of the gold rush, because there weren't very many women on the frontier. And in fact, the men who came and stayed in San Francisco, the Chinese men, they found jobs in areas such as childcare, being nannies, or laundry. They opened laundry shops, and we still have that legacy today. And they became cooks. And so these three jobs were where the opportunities were for those early Chinese immigrants. At the same time, they also kind of cast Asian men in these roles of looking feminine and doing feminine kind of work on the frontier.
Hmm. I think, you know, you touch on another point that I think is really important to reinforce, and that is that to what extent, to and a great extent, that is, the Western attitudes toward Asia were paternal. And perhaps that has something to do with the colonial impulse. And you see that other places, too, with Europeans going to Africa, to South America, to Asia, Europeans who thought they were the high point of human evolution, and that that these people that they encountered were their relatives in a sense, but also that they were like children. They were children. They were little brothers and sisters. They were people. They were benighted savages, and that we, the Europeans, were going to bring them all of the marvels of life as we have made it. And that kind of thinking, that kind of posture, for a long, long time, maybe not so much anymore, but for a long, long time, that characterized the way that Westerners, Europeans and Americans, thought about Asians.
That's right. And it's interesting when you look at some of the historical statements even that our political leaders have made. You know, former President William H. Taft called the Filipinos our little brown brothers. And, you know, Lyndon Johnson, you know, referred to Goh Dinh Diem as our boy, you know, in Vietnam. And throughout history, these statements have been very paternal ones, and it does reflect how we have historically viewed the region as kind of a, we're the patron of this kind of dependent and in fact, submissive of region of the world, which, in fact, when Asians have come to challenge us economically, for example, the case of Japan in the 1980s, you know, that was something that very much rattled us in the United States. We were afraid that, you know, Japan was going to come and buy up all of America, and we couldn't quite believe that this nation that we had conquered in World War II and occupied for 7 years was suddenly roaring back. And we see those same kind of dichotomies. It's either, we tend to view Asia as either a submissive region or a threat to us, but not something in between, which is what it really is. And we see this the same dichotomy in terms of women when we talk about the Dragon Lady or the Geisha Girl, and it's either submissive or threat, one or the other. And it's what I'm asking for through this book is that we start seeing the region much more clearly. In some ways, it is a partnership. In some ways, there are, you know, some economic challenges that we need to respond to, but it is neither submissive nor a threat, neither one of the other.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Sheridan Prosso. She's been writing about Asia for more than 15 years, most recently as Asia editor and a senior news editor for Businessweek. She's also contributed articles to other publications. If you're interested in exploring this subject, you can look for her new book. It's titled The Asian Mystique. The subtitle is Dragon Ladies, Geisha Girls, and Our Fantasies of the Exotic Orient. It's published by Public Affairs Books. And as I explained, it examines the kind of stereotypes that Westerners have had about Asia, particularly about Asian women, for a long time. And then also the other major half of the book is trying to look at reality. What she did was she spent time talking with various Asian women about their lives and about some of these perceptions and to set the stereotype alongside reality. And that's kind of the idea of the book. So it's out in bookstores if you'd like to look at it. Questions are also welcome here on the program, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone listening in, Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of comments. One is that you take a place like Hong Kong. Hong Kong is not a passive area in terms of constructing images about itself. The Hong Kong Tourist Association is a smart and very active organization that tries to develop images of Hong Kong that will appeal to foreign travelers. And I think most Asian cultures respond themselves to construct somewhat different kinds of images. That is one comment. The second comment is that while I agree with what the author has said about the Orient, I mean the Far East, it's also true that we have different kinds of images as well. that occur in different discourses. Certainly, the technology of Japan and the modernity, or the raging economic bull in China. So we've had lots of different kinds of contradictory images, and it hasn't been quite as monologic, I think, as the author has suggested thus far, although I'm sure the book is more complex than this. That's the end of my comment.
Okay. Well, I two fine points. Ms. Brasso, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, yes, of course. I mean, obviously, I'm trying to sum up things quite concisely for a radio format. But yeah, you know, it's clear that you know, some of Asian manufacturing is a very interesting example of how, again, it's a different image of Asia, but it still fits this kind of paradigm that we have. Whereas, you know, we view ourselves in the West as the sort of innovators of technology and the designers of things, and we actually take those ideas to Asia and have the Asians sort of produce them for us. So in a way, they're kind of, you know, still servants in a way, where they're manufacturing our designs and what we want. And when we talk about Chinese theft of intellectual property, well, they're stealing our property. But in fact, you know, these are ideas, concepts, innovations that we have originated in the West, and we view Asians as the ones who are either copying them or producing them for us. And so that idea still fits this dichotomy. It does get very complex, but when you sort of look at it down the line in terms of technology, you know, innovations come from the United States but are carried out by our, you know, our traditional manufacturers in Asia, and could view that in the same sort of ancient sort of trading paradigm. These are people who produce for us and we consume. The images that Asians construct for us, in part, have to do with trying to capitalize on the kind of fantasies and stereotypes that we have. And it's quite fascinating when you go to Bangkok, for example, you know, you go and see the Emerald Buddha, and you go to the palace and see all of the sites on the Chao Phraya River, for example. One of those sites that is actually part of the tourist itinerary in Bangkok is the Red Light District. And the idea, this is the Red Light District that flourished during the Vietnam War, started more or less for catering for the American GIs on R&R from Vietnam. Still there today, still very vibrant, and an enormous revenue creator for the Thai government, and something they, you know, tend to want to try to minimize, but at the same time are quite dependent on economically. And you see also these images of kind of come to Asia, come be seduced by Asia, even in things such as the Singapore Airlines ads, for example, which depict a host as kind of inviting you to the exotic allure of the Orient. And so a lot of what Asian tourism images are constructing are kind of capitalizing on what they know Westerners want.
Yes, I think that's a very good response. I have. Follow
sure,
up question?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What do you think happens when travelers, business travelers, tourists, or whatever, actually go to Singapore and Hong Kong and to these Asian countries? What do you think the actually being there does to these sort of pre-trip, you know, generalized understandings that we have? What about the experience of being there? What do you think about that?
I think that anyone who's going in fully with open eyes will realize that, you know, these cultures really aren't a whole lot different from our own at their very root. But at the same time, I think people always sort of are hoping for sort of that exotic undercurrent somewhere to spring up or pop up and are in fact looking for it. You know, I tell one of my own stories in the book, which I, you know, I'm slightly embarrassed about now, but it did happen to me when I was 23 years old, which is that when I had moved to Hong Kong, I every day there was a concrete wall out in front of my apartment, and I knew that the Cantonese people of Hong Kong believe there are sort of spirits in everything, in the trees and in the mountains and in the rivers and things like that. And so I thought, well, you know, this concrete wall must be a terrible affront to the mountain gods in the eyes of the Cantonese, and this is something I had just imagined in my head. And every day or every couple of days, someone would come by chanting quite loudly in the neighborhood. It was a man, and he would come by and sing his sing-songy chant. And I would get very excited about this and think, wow, I wonder if he's appeasing the mountain god because this concrete wall is such an affront to nature. And it was quite a silly thing, and I'm not sure I really believed it, but I wanted to believe it because I wanted to believe that even in a modern built-up city like Hong Kong, that there was still this remnant of sort of some sort of undercurrent of exoticism. And one day I went and got my roommate who spoke fluent Mandarin and Cantonese and said, come listen, the chanting man is here again. And she came over to the balcony and heard what he said and turned to me and said, you know, he's collecting scrap metal. And at that moment, at age 23, living in Hong Kong, I really changed my thinking and my focus. I really could never see Asia quite in the same way again.
Right. So in other words, that people have experiences in those other countries that that change these stereotypes.
You know, it's my hope that that is the case, but I don't think it's always the case. I think people see what they want to see in a lot of cases. People look for what they want to look for. And even people I know who have, you know, so much experience in Asia, who've worked there over the years, don't quite realize the subconscious effects of the images that we have in Western culture. And so, for example, when Charlie's Angels 2 came out last year, there's the promotional picture. If you go into the video store now and rent Charlie's Angels 2, you will see on the cover of that movie, there's the three angels, right? Two of them are Caucasian, and one of them is Asian, Lucy Liu. And Lucy Liu is the only one wearing spaghetti straps, a spaghetti strap shirt, and has cleavage. And she's the one obviously looking the most sexy and alluring out of the three. Now, I challenge people, even if they have many, many years of experience working in Asia and feel that they don't have any sort of preconceptions or stereotypes at all, if they didn't notice when that poster came out, that was a promotional poster all over the United States, if they didn't notice that the only person with cleavage in that photo was Asian, then they really need to read the book, I think, because we really need to open our eyes and realize how much our perceptions really shape what we think in very subconscious ways. I mean, unless I was looking at this issue, because I was writing this book, I might not have noticed that myself.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. Well, I'm taking too much time, so I'll get off.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
We appreciate it. We have somebody else here we'll get right to, and I think I should introduce again our guest, Sheridan Prosso. She's a journalist and has been writing about Asia for more than 15 years. She has been Asia editor and senior news editor for Business Week. She's contributed articles to other publications as well, including Time, The New Yorker, The New Republic, The New York Times, The L.A. Times. She's an advisor to the Asia Society's Social Issues Programs. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and also the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. Now she's making her home in New York City. The book, if you would like to read it, the book we've talked about here, it's titled The Asian Mystique, and it's published by Public Affairs Books. And questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have someone here in Rantoul, nearby community, line number 4. We'll go there. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have a question to the author as far as what she feels that the role of women, females, are in the Asian society. And I know that's a very broad and general question. I know that I've had I had an encounter with a lady from mainland China 2 years ago that still expressed to me that she used her hands and said, Chinese man here, Chinese woman, and she put it way low. And from what I had seen as far as pictures and the news that they were able to watch from China, that I still saw representation of women as used very high voices, like they were young girls talking, and as far as entertainment, pictures commonly within homes of pictures of women on the wall of adult men, but also Barbie doll. You know, I mean, even Barbie doll as a picture, as a poster on the wall of some of the homes. And I was told that sometimes they put pictures up when they want to try to work to obtain looking like that person, or if they want to have a child, they put up pictures of what they want the child to look like. But it seemed predominantly, I didn't see any pictures of men up. And I guess this seemed, they expressed that this was a common thing. And I wonder, it seemed that the family seemed to express that on the weekends, the family seemed to separate quite a bit, and any of their socializations were with their colleagues, their business, etc. And I wondered if entertainment for businessmen still include, I'm not saying prostitutes, but women maybe from the company or another company that is expected to be there and entertain, dance, and sing and whatnot, because I've been told that they have quite a drinking culture. And I'm not saying that I know this per se, other than this is what's been told to me recently. And I'm just open to hear information as to how the culture is and how women are viewed, and are they still in TV and media. I've heard that they have a very popular, I guess it's like MTV, and they actually call it 3-point, meaning referring to the woman's body, show. And I'm not sure that that is what the TV calls it, or if it's just a common terminology that everybody refers to this TV show. And it seems to be that more than MTV just for teenagers here, it seemed to be a cultural show that many, many families of all ages watch, and this is for entertainment, et cetera. So I wondered about feminism. I wondered about discussion. I wondered about how the role of women has changed, and if maybe Asia is somewhat responsible for some of the negative thoughts about their own culture. Thank you.
Well, that's a lot. That could keep us going for a while here.
Well, that could take another whole hour, couldn't it?
Yes, easily we could take another whole hour. Well, I can give you about 20 minutes because this indeed is the other, as I mentioned, that part of the book has to do with images, stereotypes that Westerners have of Asia and have it a long time. The other part of the book is just what the caller is asking about, because you did indeed try to spend some time and talk with Japanese women, Chinese women, Filipinas, women in Thailand, and ask them some of these very questions of men, try to find out about their lives, something about relations between men and women, how they perhaps thought of the very stereotypes that we've been talking about. There's a big piece of the book, and that's what it's about.
That's right. Yeah, it's important to keep in mind that Asia is not a monolithic culture, and quite clearly, I mean, the experience of, say, communism in China, in which Mao Zedong told the Chinese people that women have to hold up half the sky, and in fact put women in senior managerial positions and running companies in China, has had a real impact on how the role of women in Chinese society has changed. And in fact, in China today, essentially, if you look at some of the statistics about women in management or professional women or things like that, you'll find some real similarities to the case in the United States. Women there grapple with issues of working full-time and trying to find health care, and childcare is the same as we do in the United States. And in that sense, Chinese society and American society is quite similar. Japan, it's quite different. A lot of the issues that you talk about are quite prevalent. Strict division in socialization between women and men, and women tend to want to socialize together. They don't want to go out with men because men are kind of boring, and they talk about boring stuff, and they drink and stuff like that. So the idea that women have about their place in society and their role is actually one where they feel that American women don't get it. They think American women try to have it all, and they can't have it all, and that's why they're unhappy. And a lot of Japanese women think, look, I worked until I was 25. I quit. I got married. I had a child. And now in sort of, you know, as the child goes to school, I get to go out with my friends and we, you know, pursue our own activities and hobbies. And this is fine for us. We enjoy our lives. Now, of course, not every Japanese woman is happy with that. A lot of women do try to continue to have careers in the workforce. But in fact, it's really quite a complicated issue of women there have been sort of a different idea of what it really means to be a woman in society. And the idea, which is quite profound, is that, you know, you American women want too much and you can't do it all. And in fact, some of the discussions that we have with feminism in America certainly center around that point. Can we do everything? Can we have careers and a satisfying family life and everything we want in life at the same time? The Japanese certainly have a different take on it, and it's quite interesting to explore. As to the idea that, you know, Asian cultures are responsible for a lot of what we do think of them, well, that's partially true. I mean, you know, Japanese society has its own problems. Chinese society certainly has its own problems. One of the big issues that sort of drives a lot of Asian women to, one thing we haven't talked about is the issue of Western men partnering with Asian women, which is a very common phenomenon. That it's the highest numbers of interracial marriage in the United States are between American Caucasian men and Asian women. And part of that reason is not just the phenomenon of war brides, which we saw happen in huge numbers after World War II and other conflicts in the Korean War as well. The idea that that this is some sort of, you know, ideal marriage is really quite a big part of our mystique in what we think about Asia. And it's one of the things that, you know, I was exploring when I was in Asia was, you know, there's this old joke we have that goes, heaven is an American salary, a Chinese cook, an English house, and a Japanese wife. And hell is a Chinese salary, an English cook, a Japanese house, and an American wife. And, you know, if you tell this joke in Japan, people think, that's very strange. You know, we've never heard of such a thing. And they'll tell you a Japanese joke, which goes, you know, a Japanese man bows slightly to his colleagues, 15 degrees to his boss, and 45 degrees to his wife. And so the perceptions are really quite different on both sides of the ocean. Mm. And so that's one thing that I really tried to illuminate in this book.
Well, what particularly, to the extent that you've had the opportunity to talk with various Asian women about it, I guess I'm wondering particularly what they think of this Western stereotype of Asian women as being hypersexual.
Yeah, a lot of it's particularly the issue of servility that they find very strange. You know, a lot of the women I've talked to who've encountered Western men have asked me questions like, well, why does he expect that I serve his food or, you know, scrub his back in the bathtub? I mean, did he see something in a movie somewhere he thinks that's what Asian women are like? And this is something that also quite affects Asian American women in a very big way. You know, there's you know, I have an Asian American friend who writes a column for Time Out magazine, and she wrote about this once. She said, you know, look, apparently my black hair and olive complexion scream out, I'm great in bed, or I'll pour your tea and massage your feet. And she wondered, you know, why is that? It is because of all of the images that we have seen historically in Hollywood and on TV.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I just want to mention our guest, Sheridan Prasso. She's a journalist. She's written for a number of years now about Asia. She's been Asia editor and senior news editor for Business Week magazine. She's the author of a newly published book which explores this territory that we're talking about. Her book is titled The Asian Mystique, and it is published by Public Affairs Books and is out in bookstores now. Just came out officially, I guess, a couple weeks ago, so you can seek it out. And questions are welcome, too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. I wonder, perhaps I'm thinking back to some of the issues that the first caller raised. Now that we are seeing a lot more popular culture items, Asian popular culture items produced in Asia, often initially for an Asian audience. And I'm thinking about, I guess, primarily film, but also things like anime and manga, you know, Japanese animated films and comics, graphic art that primarily may start out being for an Asian audience, but also is starting to be exported. And a lot of people here in the United States are fascinated by these things. And I'll admit some fascination myself. Whether the kinds of images that are contained there, do they challenge at all the received image we have of Asia? Do they reinforce the image that we have?
Well, it's kind of interesting to look at Quentin Tarantino's work in this regard. You know, his movies Kill Bill borrowed a lot of that imagery and sort of broadcast it widely across America. But when you look at what he actually took, he took the images that fit in quite well with our stereotypes, which is that the idea of the sort of Asian male being weak and these sort of phalanxes of karate chopping incompetent males being easily beaten by Uma Thurman, you know, by a kind of a tough, bigger white woman is sort of an image that, you know, you could argue is taken from Asian culture anime and sort of brought but yet fits in quite well. The idea of, again, of the Japanese schoolgirl but also kind of the dragon lady in that same film. It's interesting that the images that resonate here are the ones that sort of already fit into the images that we already have. But I think that as more and more people sort of experience the real, the rest of those images, the entire reality of it, actually read the original manga and receive the original anime, it's quite fascinating how that may start to change our perceptions, and I do hope that happens. You know, I happen to have, been in DuPage County recently, and you know, met some 12-year-old girls who actually are learning little bits of Japanese here and there because they're reading the manga comic books. So it's quite fascinating that there is this interest, in particularly in Japanese culture. But again, I would caution that. You know, it's just because we learn about one culture doesn't mean we can understand the totality of Asia. And it really is a very, very diverse and complex place, you know, with, you know, hundreds of languages spoken and, you know, 2 billion people in the region as a whole. And so trying to understand its totality is something that we can't really do. What we need to do is sort of look at cultures individually and people as individuals, rather than, oh, Asians are all like this, you know, Asians are all, you know, smart or nice or, you know, good at math or something like that, which is the way that we kind of view Asians through this sort of model minority stereotype in the West, which, you know, in one sense, it's people think that's good in a way, but it's also patronizing because it doesn't really allow the people who are on the receiving end to be individuals, to not be good at math if they're not, or, you know, to not have to be nice if they're actually not, or whatever they are as individuals. By kind of grouping people into categories, I think it's sort of a subliminal kind of racism that's very destructive.
All right, let's talk with some other people who are listening. In the order they came in here, we'll go first to a caller in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm trying to decide which of the questions that came to my mind to ask, but I think I'll go with something that just recently you talked about, was that since it seems that all, we're used real, you know, quasi terms here, all cultures, when they write about other cultures, usually do just what we did with the Japanese and the Chinese, the brothel thing. And it just goes back and forth like that. And I just wonder if you've ever thought about, you know, since almost the impossibility of writing a great novel or doing a good opera or a good movie without those stereotypes.
Well, what do you think?
I think one of the reasons that we embrace a lot of the stereotypes we have is because they resonate deep within us. You know, we love the idea of a kind of, you know, the undying love of a woman, right? And so that, when placed in the Japanese context and the idea of Madame Butterfly, of course that is going to resonate with us. Is that the actual reality? Well, no. You know, one of the things I went to do in my book was I went to Saigon. Now called Ho Chi Minh City, but many people still call it Saigon. And I met a woman who had a baby with an American GI, and this is exactly the story of Miss Saigon, which was, in fact, a remake of the story of Madame Butterfly. And she had never heard the story before, and I, you know, told her that, you know, the the woman is pining away for the love of this man, and American man who's gone away, and she's got the child, and you know, he comes back to see her with his new wife, and she kills herself and gives the man and his American wife the child to raise. And you know, I told her the story, and she looked at me kind of quizzically and said, "Well, why would you kill yourself? What a ridiculous thing!" And of course, you couldn't. You know, no woman would do that. And I explained that this story, Miss Saigon, was in fact a remake of a Japanese story. And she said, "Oh, well, maybe it's because they were Japanese women. I don't know. But Vietnamese women would never do that." So it's quite interesting to see what the realities are when you sort of bring over. And that's how I set up the second half of the book, is that I took the images that we've constructed, the Suzy Wongs, the Madame Butterflies, the Miss Saigons, the Dragon Ladies, Dominatrixes, and all of those, and tried to say, well, what's the real situation here? And, you know, maybe it doesn't quite make for the great novels and the moving operas, but because that's reality, it's not fiction. That's why.
All right, let's talk with someone in Oak Forest, line number one. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about the difficulties it seems like the Japanese or the Japanese government is having in giving apologies because of the war atrocities. First it was Korea, and now we're hearing about Chinese. Is this anything to do with the culture, or is it other things?
It certainly does have to do with the culture, and in fact, it is yet another example of how, you know, we in America can't just talk about Asian people, right? You know, I mean, certainly the animosity between the Chinese and the Japanese is historical, and exacerbated by the atrocities that the Japanese committed in China. And so to kind of lump everybody in the same category as Asian and say, oh, well, Japanese, Chinese, they must be all the same. Well, in fact, the kind of antipathy between even the Koreans and the Chinese, or the Koreans and the Japanese, and the Japanese and the Chinese, you know, all of those groups are, you know, as big rivals as you know, say the Germans and the French, and even more so. And so that, I think, kind of drives home the point and allows us to see a little bit more clearly that there really are these tremendous significant cultural differences within Asia itself.
Oh, thank you. Then you would equate it to what went on in Europe between, like you said, the Germans and French and the Germans and all the other groups. It is equal. It's not purely an Asian phenomenon.
Oh, not at all. In fact, you know, one of the interesting things that we're able to do in American culture is say, oh, well, you know, in our minds, we understand the difference between, oh, this is a French person, and this is a German person, and that's an Italian person. And we kind of have an idea of the cultural differences between those three groups of people, or an English person, or whatever, right? We understand that because we have more familiarity with Europe. In Asia, it's exactly the same thing. You know, Korean culture is as different from, you know, Thai culture as Italian culture is from British culture, and we certainly need to kind of learn more and probe more deeply to understand those kind of cultural differences.
Thank you very, very much.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I have two comments to make. Actually, the previous caller just brought out a very good point, and also the author brought up a very good point, the diversity within Asian culture. And just like the author mentioned, there is a big difference between Chinese culture, Japanese culture, and Korean culture. Me, myself, I actually am ethnic Chinese. I grew up in China, so the culture there is very different from Japan and Korea. Another comment I'd like to make is the role of women in China. And growing up in the communist China back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I noticed there is a big difference between women of different generations. For example, my mom, she's a very traditional Chinese lady, and I took care of my father, taking care of the husband. But the next generation, people like ladies and girls who grew up under the communist China, they actually, their perspective of the world and their perspective, their marriage, I think is very totally different from that of the previous generation. And you see a lot of girls in the professional world, they're pursuing a career. And so that's another point I'd like to make. A third comment I'd like to make is the femininity of the Chinese man or Asian man. One thing I want to point out is in the traditional, historically, if you look at the Chinese opera or Chinese novel, you would notice a lot of the male characters, the leading characters, they're portrayed as a very feminine male. So there's, I just remember when I was a little kid, when I go to the operas of the traditional Chinese opera, you see all the leading male character, they look very feminine. They, according to the Western standard. So I think there's a historically, traditionally, the male, there's lack of masculinity in the Chinese culture. So that's just my comments. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I'm afraid we're going to have to give the caller the last word because we're here at the end of the time, and as we said a little bit earlier, we could, I'm sure, talk about the subject for another hour and find enough things to talk about, but we've exhausted our time. So,
well, can we just say the book is available on Amazon.com as well?
Yes, you certainly may, because I certainly would encourage, if people are interested in writing in reading more, they can look for the book, The Asian Mystique. It is published by Public Affairs Books by our guest Sheridan Prasso, and I'm sure that online or at a bookstore near you, people can find the book. Ms. Prasso, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Programs here on WILL are made possible with support from the Sinfonia de Camera, presenting an evening of romance featuring pianist Ian Hobson, 7:30 p.m. Saturday, April 30th in the Follinger Great Hall at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The performance will include Schumann's Piano Concerto in A Minor and Serenade No. 1 by Brahms. For more information, call 333-6280. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with journalist and novelist Philip Caputo. In 1970, he was a young reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and he was one of the first reporters on the scene at Kent State University when four students were killed and nine others were wounded in May of 1970. We'll talk with him this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's turn our attention now to the Chicago Board of Trade. May wheat trading at 325.5, up 8.25. July, 335.5, up 8.25. May corn, 204.75, up 1/4. July, 213.75, up 3/4.